March Madness has officially come to a close, and while the Florida Gators lay claim to a national championship on the men's side of things for the first time since the days former NBA players such as Corey Brewer, Joakim Noah, and Al Horford, who is still going strong in his 18th season, roam the campus in Gainesville en route to back-to-back titles in 2006 and 2007, alongside the UConn Huskies on the women's side for the first time dating back to when Breonna Stewart fully stamped herself as the queen of Storrs, Connecticut, after she captured her fourth straight natty back in 2016. The time has come for us basketball fans to shift our focus fully back on the NBA, where teams enter the final week of the regular season still fighting for the right to not only secure a spot in the playoffs, but for the right to hold home court advantage in the opening round to try and place themselves one step closer to the Larry O'Brien Trophy. Hello, world, and welcome to the New 24 podcast. This is the Clyde Drexler, Elgin Baylor, Chris Middleton, and Jimmy Butler episode for all of those keeping an official count of the numbers from the scores table or wherever you may be listening in from, and that's number 22, is we truly appreciate you for taking a moment out of your day to tap into us, sharing our thoughts on the game we come to know and love is the association. I'm your host, Gabriel Wilkins. And I'm joined, as always, beside my partner and co-host on the board, and Torrance Stagger, to talk about it all. It's the final week of the 2024-2025 campaign. How you feeling?
Hey, man, I'm feeling great. Episode 22, April 9, 2025, a 22 day. You into numerology, then you know what that means, man. It's a great day to build something. We building something great over here at the New 24. Never doubt how the universe works.
Yes, indeed. I like that. I like that. On the most recent episode of the New 24, me and Torrance sat down to share our thoughts on the Memphis Grizzlies' sudden firing of head coach Taylor Jenkins after six seasons with less than 10 games to go during the regular season, and what eventually led to his dismissal out in the 901, in addition to the historical month of March that was for the Oklahoma City Thunder. As we also sought to discuss which playoff teams will have the most on the line come time for the postseason, and much more in our inaugural four-question segment. Now we'll both take some time to discuss some breaking news that just came forth regarding a squad out in the Western Conference, as well as the players we believe will be among the 15 guys selected for a spot on the All-NBA team at season's end, including our official conviction on who we think has put together a resume worthy enough of winning Defensive Player of the Year honors, as we will seek to put an official bow on the 2024-2025 campaign, sharing some of our favorite highlights and moments to take place throughout the regular season and so much more. Yet prior to us getting into the main topics this week, let's take a little moment of time to give kudos to the best of the best over the last week as part of our opening tip-off segment, beginning with a pair of all-star teammates who recently managed to make history in the same contest, and Anthony Edwards and Rudy Gobert of the Minnesota Timberwolves, as Ant-Man became just the fifth player in NBA history and the youngest ever to knock down 300 three-pointers in a single season, joining the greats Stephen Curry, James Harden, and Klay Thompson, in addition to Detroit Pistons guard Malik Beasley, who also reached the same mark just 9 minutes prior to Edwards against the Memphis Grizzlies, while Gobert joined the icon Will Chamberlain as the only players in NBA history to construct consecutive games with 20-plus points on 90% shooting or better and 15-plus rebounds is the French center's 23-point, 19-rebound evening against the Big Dipper's hometown Sixers out of Philadelphia will prove to be enough to help Minnesota earn a 114-109 win on top of a former back-to-back MVP and All-Star who also joined a former Kansas star in the record books this week, and that is Giannis Antetokounmpo of the Milwaukee Bucks. The reigning Eastern Conference Player of the Week recently joined Chamberlain and another Hall of Famer, Oscar Robertson, as the only players in league history to record back-to-back contests with 35-plus points, 15-plus rebounds, and 10-plus assists, as the man who guided Milwaukee to an NBA Cup a few months ago posted a game-high 36 points to go beside 15 boards and 10 dimes to guide the Bucks to a six-point win against the Heat out of Miami, all the while becoming the first player to record at least 70 points, 30 assists, and 30 rebounds over any two-game span since Chamberlain did it back in 1968. And last but not least, Ivica Zubac of the LA Clippers, the Croatian center became the first player in NBA history to put up at least 25 points and 10 rebounds in a game without missing a single shot or committing a turnover in a recent outing against the Dallas Mavericks, as Zubac finished his 25-point, 10-rebound exhibition, shooting a perfect 11 of 11 from the floor and 3 for 3 from the free throw line in 28 minutes of floor time to guide the Clips to a 31-point rout of their West rival. We also would get a chance to see Stephen Curry and Nikola Jokic score 52 points and 61 points, respectively, on the same exact date to open up the month of April in grand fashion, as the Joker's historic triple-double outing, combined with Curry's scoring explosion, marked the first time in NBA history where multiple MVP recipients scored at least 50 or more on the same day, not to mention the announcement that Carmelo Anthony and Dwight Howard will receive official enshrinement into the Naismith Basketball Hall of Fame not once but twice this coming September, as the two stars were announced not only as members of this year's 2025 class, but also as members of the 2008 U.S. Olympic men's squad that captured gold out in Beijing nearly 20 years ago, as Anthony and Howard starred on that squad beside Dwayne Wade, LeBron James, and Chris Paul, known as the Redeem Team that helped to ignite a run of five consecutive Olympic titles and counting for the red, white, and blue. So shout out to them. Torrence, when you look back over the last several days, what were some of the top storylines, teams, or players that have managed to stand out to you since we last linked up to talk on all things as it pertains to the NBA?
First and foremost, shout out to the Duke Blue Devils for being who the Duke Blue Devils have always been. A bunch of fucking losers. And shout out to Jason Tatum too, man. He the only Duke Blue Devil besides, I guess, Kyrie to actually have a productive NBA career. We'll see what Cooper does. Anyway, we start off with Luka Doncic and SGA. That last game the Lakers and Thunder played. Hey, SGA came out like he wanted to show Luka that he was top dog now. He came out very aggressive in that first quarter. And Luka responded and put belt to ass, man. Lakers took care of business against OKC. And lastly, just want to, you know, shout out Melo, Dwight Howard, and the 08 Olympic team for making the Hall of Fame. Definitely is a sign we getting up there in age. We've seen those guys' whole career from beginning to end. And, you know, I'm sure at some point we'll further elaborate on that.
Oh, for sure. And I can't let you throw Grant Hill under the bus. He had a productive NBA career.
He the first person I'm throwing under the bus, actually.
Oh, Lord. No, don't do that one. Grant Hill was the first guy to have success at the NBA level, I would say, that came out of Duke.
Nah, man, look. Hold on. Kyrie, time out. Nah, let's pause it. Stop. Let's pause it real quick. Let's pause it. Hey, shout out to Grant Hill, legend on and off the court. You know what I'm saying? Felaz, R&B family member. You know, I'm going to keep it respectful. You know what I'm saying? One of the top
shout
line.
Shout out to Mia.
Yeah, one of the great line dancers ever in Black history. But yeah, outside of that shit, man, I mean, like, cool. He was a nice prototype. He's the prequel to the LeBron James, Tracy McGrady's, da da da, and all of that. You know what I'm saying? But hey, you ran on the top with short like leprechauns. Shout out to Notorious B.I.G. That shit was quick, fast, and done and over with. He let T-Mac down. We gonna talk about that.
The Pistons
ain't win shit when they had him.
I understand, but
you want to talk about them Phoenix days because you love the Phoenix Suns team? You want to talk about the little brief comeback?
He overcame a lot of his career with injuries and setbacks. I mean, I'm just saying, kudos to him.
All right, look, I got Elton Brand over Grant Hill. I got Luol Deng over Grant Hill. I got Shane Battier over Grant Hill. That's not even to talk about the Brotherhood Duke era when we talk about Kyrie, Zion, Jason Tatum. Shit, Brandon Ingram's had a longer, more productive career than Grant Hill. Like, come on, bro. We ain't have his shoes and Tamia, man, we wouldn't care. And yeah, he was the Black Duke representative in the 90s. But that's over with now.
I understand that's over with. But
JJ Redick.
In my opinion, Grant Hill is one of the best players to come out of Duke still to this day. And I still would rank his prime years ahead of many guys' top prime years in the league, just personally speaking.
Even though you was 4 and 5 for them prime years,
So what?
last point on Grant Hill and being a Duke guy, he the big hater responsible for Jason Tatum not playing in the Olympics this summer. So yeah, like let's just call it what it is. But let's keep the show going.
Yeah, let's do that. I only have a couple of things that stood out to me over the last week personally. And I'll start out with the Ja Morant situation. To quote Memphis's own Finesse 2 times on this song that us rap fans know is back in if you're not up on it. It's cool when they do it, it's a problem when I do it. We saw Morant exchanging a finger gun gesture with Warriors guard Buddy Hield and their bench in the Grizzlies' most recent outing against Golden State, as both players received warnings from the NBA for the gesture. However, Ja decided to take things to the next level, making the same gesture twice after knocking down a couple of threes in a primetime tilt against the Heat on the same exact day that the league warned him. And as expected, the two-time All-Star guard got hit with a $75,000 fine the next day. Some say that the fine was deserved. Others, including myself, hold the personal sentiment that he was targeted. Now, does that mean because I feel he's become the target child of the league that I can't see the other side? No. However, it's hard for me to change my stance on it when I see other players, such as Dog Connect of the Los Angeles Lakers, doing the same celebration after he hit three. Yet no one says anything about it. I understand that Ja Morant is no stranger to league headquarters, which has led to Commissioner Adam Silver keeping a much closer eye on him than others. I won't use this platform to get into those matters, as you can go do the research on your own if you don't know, and I would encourage you to do that if you don't. But we can be on two different sides of the fence as far as opinions go and call a spade a spade. And for us to act otherwise, in my opinion, is for us to be oblivious to what it is that we see. Now, you don't have to like Ja Morant as a role model for your children or even his confident persona that he exudes and clearly lets you know that he does when he's on the floor. But what you can't deny is that he's a fun player to watch when he has it going, and that the league has a base of fans who identify very strongly with him and always will, because they find him to be an authentic figure, unlike some others. Whether those around the league consider him as their ideal face of the league or not. And for the other thing that stood out to me, it's a team that's turned their fortunes around completely over the course of the last decade in the LA Clippers. You know, you talk about how we're getting older, right, Torrance? There was once upon a time when we were kids where if you saw the LA Clippers on your favorite team schedule, you typically counted the contest as a win before seeing them take the floor. This was a franchise that at one point in time was considered not only the biggest laughing stock in the league, but also among all of the major North American professional sports leagues, as you could always count on the Clippers to not only sit among the bottom of the Pacific Division standings, but the entire Western Conference. And it was always this way, with the exception of a couple of years in the early 1990s and the 2005-06 season, when they did manage to shock a few people here and there by reaching the playoffs with players such as Ron Harper, Danny Manning, Mark Jackson, and a guy that you mentioned earlier when talking about the Duke Blue Devils and former member of the program himself, and Elton Brand. However, since the acquisition of Blake Griffin, Chris Paul, and turning the page on the Donald Sterling era, albeit forced by Adam Silver to do so, the Clippers have managed to string together 14 straight winning seasons dating all the way back to the 2011-12 lockout season. This currently marks the longest streak in the league right now and is the fourth longest streak of consecutive winning seasons in NBA history. Is you have to go all the way back to Griffin's rookie campaign to find the last time the franchise managed to finish the season below 500. I know that the Clippers are Los Angeles' second team, and Tinseltown will always be a Lakers town no matter what. I also understand that they'll be the butt of most people's jokes across NBA Twitter spaces until the eventual day comes that they manage to garner a championship, even if I may find it to be childish on the parts of some. But when you consider the fact that this team has managed to earn a trip to the playoffs in 12 out of their last 14 seasons on top of reaching their first Western Conference Finals during the decade back in 2021, I'd say that they managed to provide their fans with a quality enough product to at least rally behind and be proud of on a nightly basis under owner Steve Ballmer. And that's saying something considering the history of where this franchise once was. For those who don't know, Ballmer was the former CEO of Microsoft and has shown a willingness to do whatever it takes to bring superstar talent to the Clippers, such as Kawhi Leonard, Paul George, and James Harden, all the while pulling from his own pockets to finance the construction of his new palace known as the Intuit Dome, going as far as to purchase and acquire the Lakers' old stomping ground in the Forum for $400 million so he could get his $2 billion playpen built in Inglewood, providing the Clippers with not only their own home court separate from the Lakers, but a brand that's strong enough to stand on its own without having to share the same facility with their rival franchise as they did for 25 years. You know, we've always talked about the importance of teams having an identity across not only just the NBA, but in sports in general, Torrance. And there was a time where the Clippers' identity was losing. Now, there's a new day in the City of Angels, as there's a contingent of children across the country who will be entering high school this coming fall that can say that they've never seen a franchise ever have a losing season. And a sign that some of us who are stubborn and set in our own ways are getting old.
Yeah, man, you said all of that for me to remind you and the rest of the audience that the Clippers ain't shit, ain't never been shit, and will forever remain ain't shit. Look, bro, cool. They got a few winning seasons. But would you do all of that for the Utah Jazz or the Indiana Pacers or the Miami Heat? Because those are historically consistent franchises. Yeah, they may have had some down years, but they consistent. What's this big deal about the Clippers? Why? Because they got some of your favorite players? Kawhi,
no.
James Harden?
It has nothing to do with that. I'll tell you why.
You just told us why.
I think I made a great case.
You made a great case, and guess what's going to happen with them this year? They're going to lose in the first round. Oh, because they season now over in January, and now it's over with in mid-April. It's such a big turnaround. They always going to be second. They will forever remain second. That I won't change. So why are we talking about them? Why are we talking about them?
Because we're talking about them because
you a Clippers fan?
There was a time when they were the joke of the league.
They still a joke.
Not like they used to be.
Are you sure about that?
Like I said, I literally said in the point that I made, Torrance, when you consider where the franchise once was and you look at where they are now, I know people are going to joke until they win a championship. All I'm saying, Torrance, is that they put themselves in a great position. And with an owner that's invested in the team, the way that Steve Ballmer is, you never know what can happen a couple of years from now when free agency ramps up in 2027.
I'm going to go quick with this, just like this. The Brooklyn Nets, right? They moved. They got a new arena. They got some franchise players. They had Prokhorov in there, big billionaire Russian owner at one point, spending all the money. And where are they at now? Still the Brooklyn Nets. Just like the Clippers. The Clippers are in L.A. They always had a star player. Well, James Harden is Baron Davis 2.0. We seen Chris Paul. We seen Blake. We seen Elton Brand try to go over there as an all-star. We've seen this script before. Yeah, it's nice. New court, new arena, da-da-da, but they still the Clippers. And then next thing, Ja Morant. I'm going to say this. Look. Leo to Leo, Jaws to Leo, whatever. You take whatever meaning y'all want into that BS, right? And I know that we tend to be very stubborn people. We tend to double down on things. Is Ja moving like an idiot? Yes, he is. He know that he the one that was in the club with the gun. He know he was the one in the car with the gun. I'm sure somewhere right now there's a gun near Ja Morant. But that's his American right. I know that when a black man has a gun and when a white man has a gun, it's called two different things. When a black man has it, it's a threat. When a white man has it, it's for hunting and protection. Guess what? John know that too. So at some point, Y'all gotta decide. You gonna keep doubling down to get what you looking for, or are you gonna bend to the rules? Only time will tell in that regard. Hey, Gilbert Arenas, I seen him put it out there a couple of months ago that Ja might be the next Luka Doncic. And how Memphis look moving right now, it's not too far-fetched. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, Gilbert Arenas not the only person that's been saying that. There's been a few other reporters around the league saying it as well, such as Sam Amick and a few other guys in the industry. So I wouldn't be surprised by that either. But games got to still be played, and it all remains to be seen what will unfold over the course of this summer, which I believe will be an interesting summer. I'm not going to say a major one, but it will be interesting as teams will be active on the trade market. And some teams' fortunes, depending on where they might fall in the draft lottery, could be changed rather quickly. But carrying along from the opening customary items to discuss some news that just broke at the top of the week in the NBA out of Denver, where a head coach who helped to guide the franchise he led to their first ever championship a couple of seasons ago now finds himself out of a job. In a move eerily akin to the Memphis Grizzlies' sudden decision to fire head coach Taylor Jenkins with just a couple of weeks to go in the regular season, the Denver Nuggets decided to dismiss longtime head coach Mike Malone and general manager Calvin Booth, as the move currently comes with the team sitting amid a four-game losing streak entering the final week of the regular season. The Nuggets currently sit fourth in the West as of this recording with a 47-32 record. Malone, who exits Denver as the winningest coach in team history, posted a 471-327 record in his 10 seasons under the helm with the franchise. Booth, who played for 10 seasons across several stops in the league, served as the Nuggets general manager for the past three seasons, with his first coming during Denver's championship season back in 2023. David Adelman, son of Hall of Fame coach Rick Adelman, will take over the reins as the interim head coach after serving as one of Malone's lead assistants over the last eight seasons. Torrance, with the firing of Mike Malone, this now means that four out of the last six coaches to win the NBA Finals are no longer with the teams with which they won a championship with. What are your initial thoughts on the firing of Malone and Booth out in Denver?
Looks like the Memphis Grizzlies gave the Denver Nuggets the confidence to go ahead and do something that they've obviously been plotting on doing. I know that I told you for years, man, Mike Malone be talking too much, man. He be running his mouth like he Teflon. And Calvin Booth, he had an interesting plan that, if you know me, I spoke about, you know, trying to run the two timeline type of organization similar to what the Golden State Warriors tried to do at the beginning of this decade. And we see for the Warriors, that didn't really work out. And Denver ran into a similar situation. You don't bring back Bruce Brown. You don't bring in other veterans because you're dependent on the development of these young guys, Julian Strother, Peyton Watson, Christian Braun. But you also have a superstar three-time MVP who's in the prime of his career, who he's going to win the most games that he's going to win now in these last 3 years and the next three going forward. And you seem ill-prepared to handle that. And then we got the elephant in the room with Russell Westbrook. You bring Russ in. Let's say something about Russ that brings a little conflict, man. Him and Frank Vogel. The offense needing to be changed in his last days in Houston. I'm not going to count the Washington Wizards because we all know that's a poverty franchise and things just tend to go bad over there. But they're doing a better job, as we spoke about a few episodes ago. The timing of it, of course, is interesting. But it's also, hey, they waving the white flag. They seen how Minnesota was whooping their ass. They see that LA's more prepared to deal with them. Hell, a team that I may or may not have put some money on, the Golden State Warriors. Hey, I thought the Nuggets can handle the Warriors, but shit, the way it's looking, I don't think they can handle the Warriors right now. The blame had to be placed on somebody. And obviously, win or not, the top of that organization felt like there's going to be some significant moves to be made this offseason. And it's gonna require a brand new guy at the helm. Not Calvin Booth, not Mike Malone. But see, my thing is, it's always been reported that the ownership group isn't looking to spend much into the luxury tax. So when you got a superstar like Nikola Jokic, it's kind of almost a prerequisite. And they got football money too. So it's like, what's really behind not wanting to spend the money? Are you satisfied with one championship? Because I tend to feel that way a lot of times. That once an organization delivers a championship, they tend to feel like they did a solid by the fans, and now they can start moving in a way that's more profitable. We've seen the Dallas Mavericks do it in 2011. We've seen the Milwaukee Bucks struggle to put a contender back on the floor since they won the championship. And we see what's going on in Phoenix right now. Now, my thing is, are they looking to remain a championship team, or are they looking towards the future? You got Jamal Murray starting off with a new contract extension starting next season. And you haven't gotten much from him this year. We know MPJ is always being rumored to be on the trading block. And besides that, you only got Aaron Gordon left. So what's next for the Denver Nuggets? I know that we won't be seeing much success from them this season. Starting to look like a first round exit.
Not only a first round exit, they looking like a team that could be on the verge, possibly if they don't finish this week off strong, fighting for their life in the fucking play-in. If you want to know the truth, that's what it's looking like right now. When I look at or assess the firing of Mike Malone and Calvin Booth out in Denver, just like we talked about last week with the firing of Taylor Jenkins, when the front office is not aligned with the vision of the man that leads the huddle, situations like these happen. It does not surprise me that Mike Malone got fired. Of course, the timing of it is all jacked up. But like Torrance said, with Memphis making a decision that they did to fire Taylor Jenkins, maybe that was something that empowered Denver and the Kroenke family, who also owns the Rams, which is what Torrance was alluding to when he was saying like they got football money. When you see that happening, hey, why not? Now, Calvin Booth had a very interesting strategy. I know some people that are big time Nuggets fans, big time Jokic fans that didn't always agree with it. But when you actually read what his philosophy was rooted in and based out of, you can see teams that won championships that had similar strategies. Now, it was a bold risk to take. It was something that I know could have worked one way or another, and it didn't culminate in a title, but you did see young players starting to make strides, one of whom has been Christian Braun. But like you said, Torrance, Russell Westbrook being in the locker room, yeah, like a lot of times when that happens, I'm not trying to say he's a locker room cancer, but I would never say that. I value Russ and I respect him as a
Truth
player. He's
teller.
a bona fide Hall of Famer. But at the same time, Mike D'Antoni, when he was in Houston, one season, soon as his season was up, D'Antoni's out of there. Frank Vogel, season and a half in L.A., Vogel out of there. Soon as Russ came. Mike Malone, that's the third coach. And I think one of the things that did Malone in was his philosophy was just different than Calvin Booth. Booth wanted him to trust and rely on young players. Mike Malone initially wouldn't do that. We saw that firsthand back in Game 7 of the Western Conference semifinals a season ago. He only played Christian Braun, I want to say, like what, 8 to 10 minutes? And was playing Reggie Jackson over him? You know, like he let his hand be shown. And you could tell just watching a lot of games how visibly frustrated he was when young players weren't necessarily responding in the manner that he thought or deemed to be appropriate. So I think that's where, or that's why rather, the Denver Nuggets are where they currently are right now. And yes, this is a franchise that does not want to go over the luxury tax. And that is going to create a major problem anytime you have a guy like Nikola Jokic on your roster who, as you said, in the prime of his career, demands that you really do it. But as we know, and as you said, teams can oftentimes get very, very comfortable.
And did Nikola Jokic want Mike Malone out of there? What that thing
I'm
that
not gonna get into that, but I will answer your question. When I say I'm not gonna get into that, I'm saying more so the speculation. Nikola Jokic only played for one coach throughout his time in Denver. He's been there for 10 years, and Mike Malone was the only head coach he played for. Nikola
So?
Jokic, I would also say, has been one of the more low maintenance stars in all of the league.
We don't know that. We don't know that. See, that's the thing. A lot of players, because they're not quote unquote outspoken to the media, we tend to treat them as if they might not be outspoken in the locker room, or that they're above going to management or through their agent to let them know that they're frustrated with how things are going as far as the team is. So that's why when you were speaking about Russell Westbrook, I said, well, maybe it's not Russ directly being disruptive, but he's a longtime veteran in the league. And I can imagine Russ being somebody that calls bullshit. And hey, we seen Nikola Jokic. We just seen videos of him over the past week venting on the sideline, on the bench, about how the team was playing. And at some point, we all know that a coach's message doesn't get through. We just seen Mike Malone in a press conference saying, guys are not watching their own minutes. Guys are not watching film. If you notice that, and you know that Nikola Jokic is the star of the team, and in any other team in the league, when you got the LeBrons, the KDs, the Stephs, when things that happen with the organization, when those things happen, we tend to want to know the star player's opinion about it. But see, I can already see that the media is just going to give Nikola this pass and not push him and figure out, like, hey, was there an issue with you directly?
The media is always giving Nikola Jokic a pass, if you ask me. And yeah, I expect them to give him a pass in this situation. Plus, on top of the fact that this was his longtime coach, he never played for another coach in the league. So
Ja
therefore,
Morant had the same issue.
yes, he did. We just talked about Ja Morant,
Right.
Tony. We know that it's a double standard with him.
No,
We
what I'm saying,
understand that.
I'm talking about just the coach part where Ja said, hey, Taylor Jenkins is the only coach I played for. Now, he said that publicly, but that doesn't mean that day to day he didn't vo voice his frustrations about the way the team was being coached.
I would agree with that. I'm not in disagreement with that. I don't think it's ever a true thing is a perfect harmony between a head coach and his star player. I think the regression that they showed defensively, let it be known that Mike Malone's voice wasn't as respected as it had been in previous years. I mean, shit, they fell all the way to damn near the bottom of the league defensively post All-Star break. It was times where if you want me to single motherfuckers out, I single motherfuckers out.
There
Okay.
we go.
No. But no, seriously, there's times where I look at Jokic sometimes and I wonder, do he give a fuck defensively? We talked about Alex Saar a couple weeks ago scoring 34 points on him. Majority of those buckets came on Jokic. But see, he always gets that pass in a manner akin to another player that you brought up in the opening tip segment, Luka Doncic, because he's so gifted offensively and he puts up these gaudy numbers to where when you bring up that type of stuff, people want to start deflecting. And that's not me saying that I don't like Nikola Jokic as a player. But what I will say is that it's two sides to the basketball court. And as we know, offense sells tickets. Defense wins championship. And I love offense, by the way. But at the same time, I'm willing enough and smart enough to know and understand that at the end of the day, it comes down to who can get the most stops in the half court when you're trying to compete and capture a gold ball.
Yeah, and that's just my thing. Like, at some point, you just gotta ask these guys the tough questions about how they really feel about the day-to-day of being a player on a team. This is a team that has championship experience. They know what it's like, and they know what it feels like when things are operating the way that they should. I mean, shit, we seen Nikola Jokic's brothers almost run down on the court to protect him before. He don't strike me as a guy that's worried about voicing his opinion when it's time for things to be done. Now, of course, because it's the internet, you already see the speculation of, well, is Jokic going to be here long term? I'm not worried about that shit. I'm not worried about that. I'm worried about the here and now. Whoever's stepping in to be the interim coach, are you going to get the most out of Jamal Murray when he comes back? Are you going to extend the rotation further than Mike Malone did? Because Mike Malone will play 6-7 guys and leave it at that. And you speak about defense. If it's only 6-7 of us playing and it's high-level playoff basketball coming up, fatigue starts to set in, and we've been dealing with injuries all season.
Yeah, and something that we talked about earlier when discussing Denver this season is how they struggle mightily in the non-Jokic minutes, and that's something that has been abysmal once again for the second year in a row. And that was the biggest difference, in my opinion, when they captured the championship during the 2022-2023 campaign, is that they were able to survive those minutes. You had veterans come in, such as a Jeff Green. You had, like you said, Bruce Brown. You had KCP. Now, those guys are not in the picture, and you're relying on a set of young guys. And, oh, by the way, Dario Saric, who you signed to a two-year deal with a player option, if I'm not mistaken, for about $10 million, he don't even really get no bump at all.
He was giving DeAndre Jordan minutes. See, that's the type of shit that you get fired for. Why is DeAndre Jordan still playing NBA basketball in the regular season? And like you said, that's the backup center for Jokic. But that goes back to Calvin Booth. See, that's why in this scenario, fuck the timing. Yeah, they both deserve to go. I would have waited until after the playoffs. But shit, Mike Malone just said it out his mouth that the season was over. He didn't sound too confident about the prospects of the playoff.
You know, as we discuss the firing of Malone and Booth, the one thing that comes to mind is how everyone throughout Denver knows that the stakes coming into this season were high following the Nuggets getting sent home in the second round by the Minnesota Timberwolves last year in an epic seven-game matchup, a team whose number they once had but now appears to have there after sweeping them during the regular season and recently capturing a double overtime win against the former champ. Nikola Jokic recently turned 30 years old this past February, and while he is indeed in the midst of his prime, we know how precious this period of time is. For guys of his size and stature in the game, as most tend to drop slowly but surely off the cliff once they reach that age in their career. We see him playing through injuries night in and night out, but with time being of the essence for the Joker and an ownership group that ducked and dodged the luxury tax over the years we mentioned, not to mention their front office being hard capped by the league's restrictive CBA, which caused them to lose several players who served as key contributors to their squad on the way to a historic title run in 2023. What do you make of the Nuggets' future right now? Because they boast the seventh highest payroll in the league, and they feature an extremely top-heavy roster beside Jokic.
I mean, shit, first-round exit. And when we get to the offseason, hey, we'll wait and see what the speculation is about what they want to do next. I mean, they fired their GM and their coach. So it's not as simple as, okay, well, we know the GM they have, we know what type of moves they're accustomed to making, we know what connections they have as far as agents and certain players. Nah, they're redoing the front office. See, there's more things like to speculate on. It's like, hey, you guys gonna try to call Tim Connelly back from Minnesota? Because look at the roster he been building over there compared to what Denver's been building since he left. Calvin Booth didn't draft Nikola Jokic and Jamal Murray.
That's true.
So, I mean, who the fuck knows, man? I mean, it's the same organization that didn't max out the Carmelo Anthony years, you know, and wanted to throw a parade because they got a 50-win season out of Ty Lawson and Andre Iguodala and lost those guys shortly after. See, this Denver Nuggets shit kind of reminds me of how I was just talking about the Clippers. Like, some places just ain't been shit, man, and they just happened to get lucky one year. But other than that, this hasn't always been this upstanding or great franchise historically. So we'll see. Like, shit, they could bottom out. They could start over. Like, anything can happen. They're just lucky that they have possibly the best basketball player in the world. So if you got that, you're always in a decent position. But who knows, man? Like I mentioned earlier, we seen what Dallas did after the 2011 finals. You had a Dirk Nowitzki just ran through everybody, peak of his powers, and you undid an entire championship roster.
You know, it's so crazy to me how after they won the championship, you had a lot of people out here. It wasn't me, but I remember some of those people that did this. They were quick to say that the Denver Nuggets were the modern era version of the San Antonio Spurs. I found that shit to be comical. And I respect what the Nuggets have been able to build over the last 2 decades, but I also know how impactful two stars were to that. And if you take those stars out the equation, you don't really have much of a chance. Denver has to find out how do they maximize what's left of this thing. I'm not talking about this season. I'm talking about in the future. Because it was a statement that Michael Porter Jr. made earlier this season in an ESPN article with Ramona Shelburne. I have it right in front of me. He said, if we don't win it this year, we all know they might have to break it up. If you do that, what pieces of reinforcements are coming in? How do you find a way to keep your MVP happy? That's what I'm curious to see. As far as the future right now, I'm not really too concerned about that right now. I think their first priority needs to be finding an executive in the front office. They don't even have an acting GM right now. And if you don't have an acting GM right now, you don't really have any direction. As far as I'm concerned, head coach, hey, David Adelman, wish you nothing but the best. But I can't say whether that I expect much because of the way in which they've currently been playing. And just to put in perspective how long it's been since the last time the Nuggets lost four in a row, you got to go all the way back to March of 2023. Now, they won a title a few months later, but they already had the number one seed locked up when they began their losing streak. Now, you're in danger of falling into the play-in tournament. And Jamal Murray's missed the last five games. And like you said, when he returned, which version of Jamal Murray are we going to get? Are we going to get that guy that we saw in the 2023 NBA playoffs? Or are we going to get that guy that started the season sluggish? Didn't look like himself. They got some things that they need to figure out over there in the Rocky Mountains. And they got to do it promptly because I know that they can't afford to stand pat with the top heavy roster that they have. All right, let's move along from the breaking news out of the Mile High City surrounding Mike Malone's tenure coming to an end with the Nuggets and getting to a topic that we know gets heated the most this time of year, and that's the All-NBA discussion. While All-Star nods typically tend to get more praise and hold way more weight in the eyes of the viewing public than a player receiving all NBA honors, there's fewer spots as far as selections go for all NBA spots than for all stars. In addition to this, we also know how much all NBA nods can factor into the Supermax contract that players can earn as well, as earning it could net a player up to 35% of the salary cap instead of the typical 30% one would notice on a standard max deal. And should one have played at least several seasons and have contract negotiations coming up after making an all-NBA team in two out of their last three seasons, then a player instantly becomes eligible for the elevated pay hike. Players must play at least 65 games to be considered for a spot on an all-NBA team now, as media figures with voting privileges can select up to five players per team, regardless of position, a far cry from the day when you had to pick two guards, two forwards, and a center to make the three teams once selected. Now, I think it's safe to say that the consensus five players to be named all NBA first team come season's end will be Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, Donovan Mitchell, Jason Tatum, Giannis Antetokounmpo, and Nikola Jokic, as these guys have been among the thick of the MVP discussion all season long. But which other players outside of those five mentioned do you believe should be in discussion for all NBA second and third team, respectively?
Well, first of all, I don't agree with the consensus. I don't have that as my five guys for first team All NBA.
Tell me who you got.
Oh man, Donovan Mitchell not on my first team. I got Anthony Edwards in that spot. Yeah, you can look, you can sit back, you can laugh, you know what I'm saying? Roll your eyes behind your glasses. But Anthony Edwards has been the best shooting guard in the NBA this season. Yeah, the Cavs have had more team success, but individually, Ant's played more games. He's averaging more points, more rebounds, more assists. And I just think on a night-to-night basis, he makes more of an impact for his team in the win-loss category than Donovan Mitchell. You know, Donovan Mitchell, he had a great season. I have him on second team with his teammate Evan Mobley, who I feel like deserves a large share of the credit over there in Cleveland because, like I've stated earlier, his play and his development will be the difference between the Cavs winning the championship or flaming out in the second or third round in the postseason again this season.
You talk about Anthony Edwards. Anthony Edwards is currently averaging a career high 27.4 points per game to go alongside almost 6 boards and 5 assists per outing, shooting a career high from 3-point land almost 40% from the floor. And as I just said earlier in the opening tip-off segment, he's just recently became one of only 5 players to hit at least 300 or more triples in a single season. I look at all NBA first team. And if it was anybody that you could make a case for bumping off, it could be Donovan Mitchell for sure. I mean, the Cavaliers are 7-0 in games without him. So that's a case that you could make against me if you want. But I tell you why I think Donovan will get the nod over Anthony Edwards. He's the main player on the best team in the East, and he's still playing at a solid enough level to where I believe they will give it to him. I get everything you're saying about Anthony Edwards. I definitely believe you can make an argument for him being first team all NBA. I just think he misses the cut just solely because one thing about these voters, it ain't us that's voting, but one thing about these voters, they always gonna reward the player that got the team with the better record. Even if that shouldn't factor into an individual honor, it always finds its way into it.
Well, that's state business, and it's my list. So I'm going to tell you what I got on second team, too, while we at it. I got Cade Cunningham. I got Donovan Mitchell. I got LeBron. I got Evan Mobley. And I got Karl Anthony Towns to round out my second team.
For second team, this is interesting. I would say for second team right now, Stephen Curry. I thought once upon a time it was up in the air, but with Golden State playing as well as they had post All-Star break, I think he's gonna garner a spot on that second team. And then I would say Anthony Edwards, LeBron James, Evan Mobley, and then Karl Anthony Towns, I think is the more deserving player of second team honors. But if I had to guess how it would go, I believe that the media wouldn't elevate Alperen Sengun over him on NBA
Man,
all
who
NBA
you
second
got?
team.
Who you got
That
Sengun and you
that's
got
what
Cat? Do you got Cat or you got Sengun? I'm asking you.
I'm gonna tell you why I'm gonna put Sengun over there. This is my personal opinion. The Rockets' success makes him an automatic lock in my eyes. They're on the verge of finishing with the number 2 seed in the West. Alperen Sengun is in the midst of a career season, and you can make a case that outside of Nikola Jokic this season, he's been one of the best centers in the league. He's averaging a double-double, 19 and 10 with nearly 5 assists a game, and he's shooting almost 50% from the floor. I just really like what I've seen from the big man out of Turkey who at the age of 22, continues to excel and get better and better each season.
Yeah, he's not the best player on his team to me. So I know people want to play this representation game of teams with the highest records got to get certain guys. Nah, man, it's all NBA. This best 15 players in the league this season, and he just missed my cut on second and third team. He didn't make none of my all NBA teams.
I feel you. I get what you're saying, but I just think that as of late, with the way that he's played, he'll garner some consideration, and I think he'll get that final spot on all NBA second team.
Now my third team, I'm gonna go backwards. I got Jaren Jackson, I got Jalen Williams of OKC, who I wasn't going to put him either, but Kevin Durant won't make the 65-game mark by 3 games. I have James Harden. I got Steph Curry. And a guy that's not getting any love whatsoever, I got Trae Young on third-team All-NBA.
Over Tyrese Halliburton.
Hey, what is Tyrese Halliburton's greatest attribute on the court? Assist. Who's the assist leader in the NBA? Not Tyrese Halliburton. He can sit his ass down in Indianapolis with the snow.
For my all-NBA third team, I'm going with Jalen Brunson of the New York Knicks. I think as long as he makes the 65-game threshold, which he's on pace to do since recently coming back and returning to the fold, I think he'll get that spot. Cade Cunningham, and I would go with Jalen Williams. It's not just the team success that puts him there, in my opinion. He's really been a solid player on that club. And Karl-Anthony Towns. And for the majority of the year, I thought he would be on the second team, but I definitely think he's a lock for an all NBA team. So I will put him on there. And then for that final spot, that's a tough one. That's a very tough one.
It ain't tough.
I'm gonna have to go with Jaren Jackson Jr. to
There
Memphis
we go.
Grizzlies. That's what I'm about to go
Yeah,
with.
there we go. Another
But
guy who had a
Trae Young, I like Trae Young's chances for clutch player of the year, but I don't think he makes it on an all NBA team this season.
Well, we don't know what that award really means. So, I mean, if you want to give it to him, go right ahead. But this Alfred Sengun shit. Hey, I'm gonna let you have that one, and we'll see what the postseason has to say about that. Luckily, this is a regular season award.
There you go. What you said, it's a regular season award. Moving away from the all NBA discussion to discuss an award that we shared our predictions on, who we believe was likely to capture it back at episode 11 of the new 24 all the way in January. And that's Defensive Player of the Year, an honor that we mutually thought was Victor Wembanyama's of the San Antonio Spurs to lose, as the second year man from France was well on his way to leading the league in blocks per game for the second straight campaign after becoming the first rookie in league history to be named to the all defensive first team on the way to garnering a runner-up finish for the Hakeem Olajuwon trophy. However, after receiving news that the All-Star center would be ruled out the rest of the way due to being diagnosed with deep vein thrombosis in his right shoulder back in late February, the award became up for grabs again. According to most sports books across the country, Draymond Green of the Golden State Warriors is currently the odds-on favorite to garner the award for what would be the second time in his career if he were to win it, while others such as Cleveland Cavaliers All-Star center Evan Mobley, Dyson Daniels of the Atlanta Hawks, OKC's Lu Dort, in addition to the Memphis Grizzlies All-Star big man in 2023, Defensive Player of the Year Jaren Jackson Jr., also being a strong consideration yet again for the honor. We know with Wemby out of the picture that this award has become a toss-up and that anyone can win it, which is why we're bringing this conversation back into the forefront. Who do you believe should receive the Defensive Player of the Year award in the coming weeks?
Well, to answer the question quickly, I'm picking Evan Mobley. But one thing I want to really talk about is this campaign Draymond was doing the last week. Hey, that shit wild as hell. Hey, buddy, you did a whole ESPN SportsCenter interview. Steve Kerr was out here calling him the greatest defender ever. I get it. I get it, Draymond. You want to make sure you solidify this Hall of Fame first ballot that you're gonna get. You are one of the greater defenders of all time. I would say he has to be no less than top 10 without thinking about it. But hey, dog, I was there when Sacramento was beating y'all by 30 points. I was there for some of them games. The defense wasn't just looking that great. Now I know that the defense goes down when Draymond's not on the court and he does a great job of directing traffic. He does a great job of protecting the rim. He does a great job switching out onto the perimeter. Like, great defensive genius. But campaigning for that award made me slide him down to like third. I was like, oh, nah, bro, it ain't even, you can't do that. You got to let the work talk. Like, defensive player of the year, that's supposed to be that's really supposed to be the blue collar award in some way in the NBA. You know what I'm saying? Get down and dirty. You know, I think about Tony Allen. I think about Kawhi before he started talking. Ron Artest, Ben Wallace. You know what I'm saying? And Draymond from Saginaw, he know better. You see, that's not letting that Hollywood shit being around Bron get to him. You out here campaigning for the awards, G. That shit crazy. Like, I get it, but damn, nigga, let the work talk. Dyson Daniels, I think it's too early to give him that award individually. Individually, he had a great season. I mean, a lot of steals, doing this thing on the perimeter. But the weird thing about Defensive Player of the Year is that you kind of notice you got to build that reputation up first before you just snatch that award. You got to put in a couple of years of sweat, some blood before we can really like determine if you the one truly making that impact for your team on that end. Lu Dort, I seen people trying to campaign for him recently as well because of the totality of OKC's defense and all of these historic numbers. Well, like I said, we saw what all that historic shit meant when they played the Lakers recently. Don't mean nothing when you got two killers that walk onto that court. Like I said, man, this postseason gonna show a lot. So the only person I trust, I'm gonna give it to Evan Mobley, man. He really been holding it down. When he's in the lineup with Jared Allen and he's allowed to kind of play free safety and clean up everything, he does a great job. And when Jared goes to the bench and he's down at the five, he does an even better job of protecting the rim. He's getting the defensive rebounds, which does count on the defensive end to me. You gotta end the possession. You gotta get those rebounds. He does a great job of doing that as well. Same with Draymond. When he switched out onto the perimeter, he's athletic enough, possession at a time to stop a guard if he needs to. And at the end of the day, man, we know this was Wemby Award, really. So, it's almost like a consolation prize this year.
You brought up Tony Allen. Shout out to that guy, man. He grew up around my neighborhood, and
Nah, say it, Princeton Park. Shout it out.
he's one of the best players in the history of the league to not win Defensive Player of the Year. It's a damn shame that he never got one. It really is.
First team all defense in
Yeah,
his
I know. I
words.
just actually watched the Grindfather documentary that the Memphis Grizzlies did on him this past weekend. It's a great documentary. If you're a fan of his, you should definitely check it out. And if you're a Chicago native that loves basketball, you should check that out as well. Princeton Park's finest. But I'll say it was comical to see Draymond campaign for it. I thought this was something he should have did a couple years ago when he actually had a case back in like 2023. But I don't see it this year. Lu Dort, on the other hand, if he wanted to campaign for the Defensive Player of the Year award, I could understand. Same with Dyson Daniels, a guy that the national media may not be as familiar with, but have recently became familiar with. But I always saw this potential with Dyson Daniels dating back this time with the New Orleans Pelicans. He just needed to be in a place where a head coach not only valued his skill set, but allowed him to grow offensively so he could see extended minutes on the floor to showcase what he already had defensively. Because defense was always Dyson Daniels' calling card. And I believe that he will not only be a first team all defensive selection, but a guy that could potentially snatch a Defensive Player of the Year award away from somebody someday. Maybe, just maybe. I think he's that good.
You playing on
But,
poverty franchises, you ain't gonna get there. The Pelicans,
oh,
not the
man.
Hawks. Hey man, you gotta play where the games count, man, to win these awards sometimes. It's the truth.
I understand all that. But with that said, I think I'm gonna go with the guy that, in my opinion, I thought should have won Defensive Player of the Year over Jaren Jackson in 2023. And that's Evan Mobley. It's not even close to me. And for people to say that he's in a two-man race with Draymond Green right now, I just think that that's not true. We talk about his versatility and his ability to guard multiple positions and protect the rim, help out on the perimeter, and guard in pick and roll situations. And even Jaren Jackson Jr., who is a candidate for this award, yet once again, has publicly argued for Mobley's case to win Defensive Player of the Year. And just watching those two go head to head last month down in Memphis, I thought Mobley stamped his case. He was named Eastern Conference Defensive Player of the Month in February. And he's averaging almost 2 blocks per game, and he's top 10 in blocks in over 30 minutes of floor time. Like I said, when he captured Eastern Conference Defensive Player of the Month honors in February, his 25 blocks were tied for the most in the conference. So I like Evan Mobley's chances for Defensive Player of the Year in 2025. He's playing on a top defense. And even though he stars beside Jared Allen, he does a lot over there, and he serves as the anchor. And I truly believe if you have a guy like Evan Mobley on your back line, that you can win a championship if you had the right pieces beside him.
Now, my thing is, I know it was something you wanted to get to. Do you feel like there needs to be 2 Defensive Player of the Year awards? Does it need to be one for the perimeter guys? Does it need to be one for the interior guys? Or you like me, where it's like, hey, it's 10 guys on the court, and everybody know who they don't want guarding them. There's always that one guy on the court, regardless of where they placed at the moment.
I think it should be 2 Defensive Player of the Year awards.
Oh, man.
And I'm going to tell you why I do. One, the league is evolving. And with so many of these teams emphasizing so many nuanced defensive schemes, I don't know sometimes whether or not a single Defensive Player of the Year award truly recognizes the contributions of players who excel, be it guarding a specific spot or area on the court. Like, you take, for example, the way that most of the media votes, they always select centers. They always select big men. And I think sometimes that undervalues the contributions of guards and wings who most nights are tasked with guarding the opposition's premier perimeter player, while usually centers focus on the paint. Now, in Evan Mobley's case, he can guard all 5 positions. So he's a unique case. Jaren Jackson Jr. is another guy as well, but he tends to get in foul trouble a lot.
Now, if you take Rudy Gobert, you take him away from that award and all those fucking awards he won, everybody else you name could guard the perimeter as well as the interior that won that award before. Dwight, in his prime when he was winning, he could rotate out onto the perimeter. When Ben Wallace was winning the awards, he could rotate out and guard on the perimeter. When you a great defensive player like Draymond said, man, we should never be taking you out of the game for defensive purposes. And a part of defense in today's NBA is the ability to switch and rotate. So I don't think that you need to come up with this second award to make people feel better about all of this shit. I get it. A lot of people felt like a guy like Jrue Holiday was the best defender in the league for a number of years, and he never got properly rewarded for that. Well, then maybe Defensive Player of the Year might could be an award that the players get to vote on, since they the ones out there really dealing with it.
They'll never do that.
Of course not.
But Tony Allen was another guy as well that I think could have benefited if you had a 2 Defensive Player of the Year award system. I'm just saying, I'm not taking away.
Mark Gasol from the big stole man. That award. Mark Gasol stole that award from Bron anyway. So I mean, I get you with that, with the TA point, but
let Tony tell you he stole it from him too. That was something that was talked about in that documentary.
That's all I'm saying, bro. But at the same time, hey, we just need one award. That's what we got all defensive teams for.
Now the thing I will say, if you have 2 awards, it could lead to voters focusing on specific positions or playing styles rather than the overall impact of the players. I'm saying I understand the argument against it, is what I'm saying. I also would say that it overcomplicates the system. That's an argument that you could make against
Man,
having two
y'all just
defensive player of the year awards as well.
These folks just want to give Lou Dort an award, man. I see what y'all
what
on.
You got against Lou Dort?
I ain't got nothing against Lou Dort, man. You got your little OKC biases you see in the media. You know what I'm saying? Like Mark Gasol clearly had a bias. Oh shit, the Rudy Gobert shit and all the advanced stats. Look, bro, we don't need all that. We know who the best defenders is. Like it's a visual thing.
It's a visual thing for those who watch the game. But ask yourself this question, Torrance. How many of these media figures do you really believe that have voting privileges actually watch the game? Because if I'm going to speak my truth on that before I let you answer, by the way. I don't really think a lot of these people that have voting privileges watch the fucking games for real. I don't.
Well, that's the thing. We over here at the New 24, so that's why we discussing what we feel like the award should be, and not these media people. I'm not a part of the media. I'm an outsider.
You know, Torrance, we witnessed a lot of historical feats reached this year in the NBA, from Cade Cunningham joining Luka Doncic as the only active players in the NBA to ever tally at least 4,300 points, 1,400 assists, and 1,000 rebounds through their first 200 games. LeBron James becoming the first player in league history to ever score 50,000 points in his career. To Kevin Durant becoming just one of only eight players to ever reach the 30,000-point club. To Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, who has scored 20 points or more in 65 straight contests, joining the greats of Michael Jordan, Will Chamberlain, and Oscar Robertson is the only players to ever accomplish the majestic feat. Giannis Antetokounmpo, a player who was once viewed as an intriguing project over a decade ago, becomes just the sixth youngest player in NBA history to reach the 20,000-point mark. Not to mention Nikola Jokic being on the verge of becoming the third player to average a triple-double in a single season, as the all-star reigning MVP is on pace to finish among the top five in points, rebounds, and assists per game this year. When you take the time to reflect back on the regular season that was, what were some of your favorite moments or highlights from the 2024-25 campaign?
I'm going to start right at the top. Brian yelling at Stephen A was definitely probably number one. I'm going to go with that for sure. I mean, you just spent the last two segments criticizing the media. Bron jumped off the porch for you, man. He went and handled that. He went to talk to the big dog and told him he was tripping. Because really, that's been the storyline of this season, unfortunately, is the way the media covers the game. That's really been the story. You just rattled off a lot of great accomplishments. But how many great games did we really get this season? I can name a few. OKC and Cleveland, both of those games, fire. The Boston-Cleveland series this year. Those were like four good games we got this season. One of my favorite games this year was Bron in the Garden. The night when we found out Luka was going to L.A., Bron just had put on a great game in the Garden without AD, Lakers rolling. And, of course, the Luka trade night. That was crazy. Oh, that was crazy. We gave y'all three episodes in a week behind that one. And, I mean, for the most part, I feel like it was a good season. We got a lot of good games. I would say I was disappointed on the national TV game side. You really had to go to League Pass this year to go find the good games. But there were good games every night during this season, for the most part. I know, what was that? Monday night with the NCAA tournament, we got two shitty games, but it's April.
As far as highlights go, one highlight that stood out to me was one that I was actually in the building to see. And that was seeing Coby White late in a game with the Bulls up against the San Antonio Spurs, attacking the rim and throwing down a jam over Victor Wembanyama where he was lacking. If Victor Wembanyama turned his head just a couple of seconds faster, Coby White getting put on his shit, and that's a block. But he threw it up and down with authority over the French big man to seal the deal in a game in which the Bulls happened to come back down double digits and earn a victory, which marked the same game in which Zach LaVine was in the midst of a run where he was putting up 30 nearly every night and had a game high that night with over 30 plus points of his own, shot 50 plus percent from the floor, That was a highlight moment for me. I'd even go as far as just recently with the Lakers getting a big time win in Indiana off a tip in from Bron at the buzzer, coming to Chicago the next night. And then you see the Bulls pull off the impossible, scoring 9 points in 12 seconds to earn a big time win in front of their fans at the Madhouse on Madison. That was another highlight win. And outside of Chicago, I would say the Boston Celtics just continuing to go on their run of dominance that they have, particularly on the road. Like, we've seen this team dominate away from the TD Garden this season. And it's been real cool to watch. And they're setting records along the way as well. Like, they just set the record for most three-pointers made in a single season as a team. And when you consider the way in which they play and the way they get a lot of shots up, I know it's not everybody's cup of tea. You know they're going to get 53s a game, but to be able to hit them consistently at the level that they have, I thought that that was very cool and fun to watch as well. And I'm not going to lie, I'm somebody that likes a lot of offense. I like teams that play five out. I like teams that like to push it up the floor and find open shooters. So that was fun as well. And then the Cleveland Cavaliers coming into their own as a group. A lot of people had questions about whether or not Donovan Mitchell would stay. He decided to stay, signed a long-term extension. Darius Garland, there was a lot of questions about him. And could he find consistency alongside of Donovan Mitchell? Well, Kenny Atkinson has proven that they can do that. And as a result, we see this team in the midst of a historic campaign out in Cleveland, and they look like the best non-LeBron James-led team in Cavaliers franchise history. I'm very curious and eager to see what they will do come playoff time.
I wish the MVP race was more exciting, and not even just far as race between multiple people, just that energy. Like, you remember the energy the MVP award had when Steph was playing in 2016, or LeBron in 09 or 2013? Shit, even James Harden campaign, where you just felt like, man, this guy is just doing it night after night. Man, yeah, SGA. You know, he put the numbers up, but it still ain't have that energy. You know, like, I still never felt like I was watching the absolute best player in the world, and he was right now having his moment. It almost feel like a makeup award from last year, kind of, more than a trailblazing season. And I know, like I said, they got the team record. He's averaging 30. You know, all the marks are there, but it's still that little 5 to 10% that's missing that really makes a season legendary.
I think most people stateside are just getting to know SGA and are becoming familiar with not necessarily who he is as a player, but seeing him become this consistent force offensively. That's just my opinion. You
Man,
can
we know
agree. We can
back.
agree or
Yeah, we know.
disagree.
Everybody that's listening to this podcast, anybody that's tuning in to anything NBA related, we don't fall into the casual sports fan category. We watch the game. We care about the game. We know who's who. And like I said, I just don't feel like SGA season really had that magic, that spark to it. We know it's a great season. Everything historically tells us it's a great season. Yeah, you know, 50 point nights and man, but you with them MVP years, you gotta have them moments. Like Steph was giving us moments during his MVP year. James Harden was out there crossing people, making them fall, hitting step back threes. Like you can just close your eyes and remember some of those highlights from this season. What you don't feel that way about SGA? That's why, like, even though we know he has the award wrapped up, that's why Jokic can continue to gain so much momentum, like I stated right after the All-Star break, because he's going to put up just as crazy numbers as well. Unfortunately for him, he was putting up crazy numbers in games they were losing, and now his coach got fired.
When you say that, it leads me to ask you this question. Does every MVP season have to be filled with highlights that captivate you in order for you to recognize it as such?
Of course not. That's what dude, I me recognizing it don't matter. He getting the award regardless. I'm speaking about me as a fan, that there are particular years that stand out. And I'm saying we talking about the season this year, wrapping it up. I just don't think this was one of those MVP campaigns.
You know, with the regular season coming to a close, we figured that we might do things a little different with this episode, in particular this week for all our listeners. Considering some of the things we saw that have caught our eye, not only over the last 20 plus consecutive weeks, but through the 82 game slate this season, as we'd like to welcome you officially to the regular season awards portion of the show as we enter the home stretch time here on episode 22 here. Of the new 24, beginning with the category that a few teams around the league can garner consideration for, and that's the most surprising team of the 24-25 season. We saw a Detroit Pistons squad go from a league worst 14 wins a season ago to tripling their win total on the way towards capturing the franchise's first playoff berth since the 2018-19 season, marking the biggest season-to-season jump record-wise in the NBA over the last 17 years. Not to mention the Houston Rockets squad go from posting a 22-60 record a couple years ago to within one win of clinching the number two seed in the Western Conference this season. As Clutch City enters the week with 52 wins on the regular season after recently locking up a playoff berth for the first time since the 2019-20 campaign and home court advantage in round one of the NBA playoffs, as Houston has guaranteed themselves at least a top three finish in the final standings. We've even witnessed the LA Clippers extend their consecutive winning season streak to 14 straight and counting to mark not only the longest active streak in the NBA, but the fourth largest in league history, despite dealing with lingering health concerns surrounding Kawhi Leonard, once again, with no Paul George in the mix this time around. Which team in the league would you say managed to surprise you the most during the regular season?
Well, damn sure wasn't the Clippers. I'm gonna go with the Phoenix Suns, man. Like shit, Book and KD was supposed to outscore their way to 50 wins this year, and that didn't happen. We thought Bud was coming in to make sure the ball moved. They brought a point guard in. None of this shit worked, man. They couldn't even get Brad to agree to get traded like during the break. Bro told them no and fucked everything up. Just surprise after surprise over there with me, man. That's the team I'm going with. I don't look at Houston as a surprise. Me and you have been tracking how that team is getting built over the past few seasons. We know what Ime Udoka does. We know the talent of a guy like Jalen Green. Thompson, he shocked some folks with his rise during the year. But we know Dylan Brooks, Fred VanVleet, they're good veteran players. You spoke about Jeff Green and his importance to the Denver Nuggets a few years ago. He's over there. Detroit Pistons. I've been saying it all year on this show. They weren't a bad team last year. They just had a coach who simply didn't give a fuck. They got a JB Bickerstaff in there, a guy who lost his job in Cleveland. He has something to prove. The team has something to prove. It was a great marriage. Nothing surprising and shocking about any of that. The Phoenix Suns sucking the way they do was a big surprise. I say it every year. Somebody has to miss the playoffs in the Pacific Division. I would have picked the Clippers or the Kings at the beginning of the season. Hey, but things change.
So much for talking shit about the Clippers and they actually made
I mean,
it.
to be who they always are, a disappointment when it counts the most.
Anyway, the team that surprised me the most in the NBA this season is a team that just recently got eliminated from playoff contention, but a team that really won me over a little bit. A team that I'm eager to see how they fare in the years to come. And that's the Portland Trail Blazers. Scoot Henderson, he started the year coming off of a rookie campaign where he didn't really look like he belonged. And even though he's coming off of the bench, backing up Ann Simons, he's starting to show signs of looking like an NBA player now than what he did a year ago this time in April. Shaedon Sharpe is starting to come into his own and has been generating buckets consistently. He just recently had an outing against the Toronto Raptors where he exploded for 36 points, marking the most points scored by a visiting Canadian player in the Scotiabank Arena this season. The Blazers actually have a defense now that you can actually show tape of proudly if you're a fan to your friend without having to put any type of plastic bag over your head. Tumani Kamara is one of the top wings in the league and a pleasure to watch. And he's been aggressive even more so in the second half of the year. And Deni Avdija has really been the primary focal point of their offensive attack. And he's helping them push tempo and even running a half-court offensive sets at times. And between Tumani Kamara picking up guards the full length of the floor and Deni finding a way to drive past a lot of them, you see them starting to use the floor in ways that they haven't done in a long time. And when I say a long time, I'm talking about like early 90s, Clyde Drexler era under Rick Adelman. It's been that long. I'm not saying that the Portland Trail Blazers are a team that is going to be a top five team in the West, but I did like what Chauncey Billups was able to get out the group this season. I really did. And as a result, I found them to be the most surprising team. If you had told me at the beginning of the season that the Portland Trail Blazers would have found a way to garner just as many wins almost, or the exact amount of wins as of this recording at least, as the Phoenix Suns, I would not have believed you.
Yeah, that makes Phoenix more surprising than the Portland Trail Blazers. But obviously, everybody out there gave. Clearly didn't hit a few parlays with the Portland Trail Blazers on it this season.
And not at all.
He wanted to give them a shout out for what they did to his pockets, and I understand.
Not at all. I didn't win any money off the Portland Trail Blazers,
I get it.
But I enjoy watching what Chauncey Billups did with that young group. And for those that may not know, I like watching a lot of young teams in the NBA. I really do.
If the I get it. The IRS check out the pod too. I understand. You want to keep that on the low. I get it, man. I get it. I'm talking about the damn Portland Trail Blazers. They ain't making the playoffs for at least another two seasons.
I'm gonna mark that down.
I know. We talked about
the teams that surprised us the most over the course of the 2024-25 season. Now let's discuss the ones who we had high expectations for that managed to let us down, and that's the team we found to be the most disappointing. We know that there were a pair of teams in both the East and West, respectively, who despite coming into the year with expectations of at least making the playoffs and featuring all-star trios, are now on the verge of heading home with their future appearing to be in limbo. Many would say that those among a couple of others might stand out the most. And for those who don't know which teams I'm referring to, it's the Philadelphia 76ers, who are currently on pace to finish with one of the top five worst records in the league this season, and the Phoenix Suns, who Torrence said he finds to be the most surprising team. A squad that displayed a solid defense for the majority of last season, beside former head coach Frank Vogel prior to his firing, only for it to falter mightily under Mike Budenholzer during his first season down in the Valley, and in turn impact them in a play-in where they currently find themselves fighting for their life. Which team across the league would you say managed to be the most disappointing to you as we reflect back on the regular season that was?
Oh, man, most disappointing team to me this season by far, the Golden State Warriors. I thought them motherfuckers were dead in the water, and they just won't die. They just won't die. Oh, man. I spent so much time just hoping they didn't get nobody for the trade deadline. Like, when Phoenix was looking like they was going to get Jimmy, I said, oh, good. They're going to really have to fight for this one. Said, if they ain't get Jimmy Butler, man, we would have been talking about, do Steve Kerr need to get moved around this offseason? Jimmy done came over there, and he's filled a lot of gaps. He's brought a lot of contributions to that team, and they will be somebody to deal with during the playoffs. No matter what I say about the Golden State Warriors as a whole, I'm going to always have faith in number 30. And Draymond, too. Yeah, man, that shit really disappointed me, man, that they just wouldn't just die off peacefully, man. They keep fighting. And another team, I would say, the Charlotte Hornets. I thought the Hornets was going to at least make it to the play-in. I thought they had enough talent on the team. I like LaMelo. I thought Brandon Miller had a solid rookie season. Miles Bridges came back in the fold. We got a new head coach over there. And sure, same old Charlotte Hornets, man. Same old Charlotte Hornets. So I know next season I won't be giving them any additional praise. I won't have any expectations for them because I don't like being let down. And I don't let men let me down. That's a woman's job in my life. But, yeah, man, I couldn't even text Gabe and add him to the parlays this season, man. Because, you know, Gabe got them. He got the numbers down pat. Can't really work out too much with the Charlotte Hornets this season.
I'm not going to lie. I've been wanting to see the Charlotte Hornets get to the playoffs for a while since LaMelo Ball's rookie year. I have. I'm not ashamed to admit that. And I thought that their ceiling was going to be reaching a play-in. But I always knew that it would be dependent on health. And unfortunately, the Hornets have now missed the playoffs in 9 straight seasons, which we talked about a couple episodes ago. And that's currently the league's longest active drought and the longest drought in Eastern Conference history. And if they don't win another game this season, it will be the franchise's third worst season since the Bobcats were born in 2004. Statistically, they have been better than they were last season, but most of that improvement has come on defense, but that's not really saying much when your defense is still among the bottom half of the league. I think a foundation is being built there in Charlotte, though, and hopefully with a healthy Brandon Miller in the mix in his third season beside LaMelo Ball and Mark Williams and Miles Bridges, they can continue to add on and build and make that next step, especially when they're more than likely have guaranteed themselves to have a top 5 pick. The team that I was disappointed the most by, though, this season is a team that for the last several years has been one of my favorite teams to watch on League Pass because of a particular player, and that's the Philadelphia 76ers. Joel Embiid, he hobbled through 19 games. Paul George played in only 41 contests. And when he did play, he didn't look like the guy that I was familiar with for the last decade or the guy that they thought they were getting when they signed him last summer. He had the lowest usage rate in the last 12 years, saw a huge drop off in his efficiency. And those two guys alone are owed more than $410 million over the next 4 years. And even though Jared McCain and Quentin Grimes showcased a lot of positive signs in their development as young players, I just don't know what the future of the Philadelphia 76ers is right now. And I thought going into the season that the Sixers had at least a top 5 team in the East. I really did on paper. But unfortunately, I was wrong. And they're more than likely going to have a top 3 or 5 pick in the draft line.
You see, that's the problem, man. You got blind faith in the wrong shit, man. You're too smart for that. Dog, Paul George is in like year 15 or 16 when they gave him that contract. We grew up knowing that, hey, 15 years in the league, we knew you was ready to retire by then. And they gave him $200 million. Joel Embiid barely got through the Olympics over the summer.
I know.
So what was you putting your faith in them for, man? Evan Turner was one of the first guys to jump off the porch and told y'all this is going to be one of the softest duos you ever seen put together. PG ain't want to go to Philly. PG wanted to stay in L.A., but I get it. If somebody going to give you $200 million and you barely holding it together physically, you got to go take that money. But for you to say you was disappointed in them, I'm almost disappointed in you, man. You a basketball savant. You know better.
Man, look, Joel Embiid, when he's healthy, he's one of my top 5 favorite players to watch.
That's that bias.
No, it's just being honest. That bias. I can have favorite players just as much as you can. But I know how to stay in between the lines.
Play both sides.
Oh, here you go. And last but not least, Let's get into the teams that made it worth the nightly watch, not only for ourselves, but the rest of our fellow NBA fans this season. We're currently in the midst of witnessing both the Cleveland Cavaliers and Oklahoma City Thunder duke it out for which team will hold the right to have home court advantage throughout the entirety of the 2025 NBA playoffs. Oklahoma City currently holds a two-game lead over Cleveland for the best record in the NBA this season as of this recording. The defending champion Boston Celtics still remain among the top of the top in the Eastern Conference standings, as the franchise that boasts a total of 18 championships is only 2 wins away from tying the 2015-16 Golden State Warriors for the best single-season road record in league history, and just 4 games behind the Cavaliers for the number one seed at the top of the week. I know that these teams I mentioned sit among the top of the top in the league this season, but are among those many enjoy watching. Which team did you enjoy watching the most when checking out games across League Pass this year?
I mean, obviously the LA Lakers, man. Like, night to night, the drama unfolds. That's all. They always had to come back. When AD was there, bro, the Lakers never won first quarters. They were always down at half, but we knew the comeback was coming. It made for many a great night. Even some wins. When Gabe sent the picks over after the second half, the first half, I was like, all right, we got one. The other team, I like watching the Boston Celtics when the score is close in the first half, but they always tend to blow teams out. And my third team, hey, man, call me a homer. But like I told y'all, this the home of basketball. Hey, the Bulls have been giving us some good action this year, man. They've been giving us some good action. Do I believe in it? No. Do I want to keep being in the midst of mediocrity and playing like we are a team in middle America for real? No. But when I'm done with work and it's 7 p.m. Central Time, hey, man, all I want is a good game at the end of the night, man. And I got to say it, man, the Bulls, they've been giving it to us.
I went to 3 Bulls games this season. I went to the home opener against Oklahoma City. I caught them against Boston. I caught them against San Antonio. I was tempted to go to the game against the Lakers when Josh Giddey hit the dramatic buzzer beater from half court. Wish I had went. I must say that they were a very entertaining team to watch this season, even though I knew what I was going to go see every time I went to Madison Street this season. I knew that. But I got some fun games, so I take that. As far as teams that I enjoy watching the most when checking out games across League Pass this year, I enjoy watching the Orlando Magic in the first half of the season, especially without Paolo Banchero seeing the emergence of Franz Wagner. I really thought prior to the injury that he was on the verge of making his first All-Star appearance. It's been very fun to watch their defense, too. You know, the rotations and the way that they communicate with one another on the floor. I enjoy watching Orlando's progression, albeit a slight setback due to injuries, but I think that's a team that still is one to watch over the next few years. But the team that I really enjoyed watching the most, honestly, was the Detroit Pistons. I felt like every time I was watching the Detroit Pistons, no matter what the deficit might have been in a given game, that they always had a chance with number two on the floor and Cade Cunningham, who has really emerged as a special leader for that group. And when you look back at the 2021 NBA draft, you had a lot of people trying to compare Cade Cunningham side by side with Jalen Green and Houston Rockets. And I think both teams managed to get what they needed. Detroit needed a leader in their building, and they got that. Houston needed a guy that could not only serve as the face of the franchise, but be that dynamic wing scorer. But when I look at the team that I really enjoyed the most watching, at least this season in the NBA, it was the Detroit Pistons, man. Just seeing those young guys emerge, like I said, Cade Cunningham. Jalen Duren is looking like one of the best young centers in all of basketball right now. And he's made tremendous strides. And to see the way the fan base was criticizing him, rightfully so, early on through the first quarter of the year. Seeing the way he responded to that, now he's become a big-time fan favorite. That's what you love to see. Ladies and gentlemen, This week may officially mark the conclusion of the regular season, but that doesn't mean that the action on the floor will be cooling off, especially in the Western Conference, where only two games separate the third and eighth seed squads from one another as of this recording, with a four-way tie between teams currently in the fifth through eighth range in the standings. Its three teams will garner guaranteed playoff spots, while the other two will have to face one another in a 7-versus-8 matchup set to take place in the play-in round next week. And speaking of the Wild Wild West, we got some primetime games between squads in the conference that you should definitely have your eyes on with all the implications at stake, starting out with the nightcap matchup this Wednesday night at 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 p.m. Central on ESPN, the place where you can catch Nikola Jokic looking to help the Nuggets get back on track and officially secure a top six seed to avoid the play-in tournament against Zach LaVine and the Kings out at the Golden 1 Center in downtown Sacramento, just shortly after watching Luka Doncic make his official return to Dallas for the first time as a member of the Los Angeles Lakers, in addition to another showdown where a guaranteed playoff spot will likely be on the line when these two teams meet and what might possibly be the biggest game remaining on the schedule, as Anthony Edwards and the T-Wolves will make their way out to the 901 to try and knock off the lone team in the Western Conference they have yet to knock off this season in the Memphis Grizzlies led by Ja Morant, as you can catch that contest this upcoming Thursday night at 9:30 p.m. Eastern, 8:30 p.m. Central on TNT, just shortly after Cavs Pacers out in Indianapolis, not to mention another Western Conference tilt on NBA TV the following evening that could potentially factor into the final standings by the close of this weekend, where Jalen Green and the Rockets will be attempting to lock up the number two seed against LeBron James and the Los Angeles Lakers at the Crypto.com Arena at 10:30 p.m. Eastern, 9:30 p.m. Central Time on Friday. We're going to have a plethora of games to watch over the course of the week that will have significant implications on how the standings shake out, not to mention all 30 NBA teams in action on the final day of the year this Sunday afternoon. Outside of the games we've already mentioned, which games should fans have their eyes on during the final week of the regular season?
Yeah, watch the games that Gabe mentioned, and then just be prepared to watch the games Friday and Sunday. The schedule is real beneficial. Got a game starting on Friday every 30 minutes. A new game is starting and through the night. And then on Sunday, all the games start at either 12 or 2:30. And I'm sure that there's going to be some games affected by seeding in those two nights. So those are the nights I'm really looking forward to, a good night to surf through and see which game cracking, which game got seeding implications, and we can all get ready for this play-in in the postseason finally.
I got a game on Friday night. You bring up Friday that I didn't mention, but fans need to watch. And in my opinion, it's a shame that it's not on national television. But if you have League Pass, check that out at 9 p.m. Eastern time, 8 p.m. Central time. And I'm talking about the matchup in the Rocky Mountains between the Grizzlies and the Nuggets. Both of these teams are tied in the loss column right now. You have a Grizzlies team, they're 1-1 against the Nuggets, who they haven't played since mid-November. Nikola Jokic missed both of those contests. I expect him to play this upcoming Friday night with all the chips on the line. That game is also going to be a game that has major seeding implications. And then at 9 p.m. that same night on Friday, 9 p.m. Central, 10 p.m. Eastern time, you have the Clippers going up against the Kings at the Golden 1 Center. The Clippers are playing to try and get them a top six seed and avoid that play-in round. They're tied in the loss column alongside of the Nuggets and the Grizzlies and the Warriors as well. You got a King squad fighting for their life, trying to survive in the playing realm of things in the standings. That's going to be a good game as well. And then on Sunday, one game in particular that you want to keep your eyes on is Pistons and Bucks, the Fiserv Forum. Two teams fighting for that fifth seed. Who wants it? You got Cade Cunningham, who just recently returned from a calf injury, going up against Giannis Antetokounmpo, who, without Damian Lillard, has just taken matters into his own hands with no problem and has shown why he will more than likely finish top three in MVP voting yet once again.
Yeah, man. And shout out to Fran Drescher and Sonny Lee NBA fans, especially Suni Lee, showed up at that Knicks game, provided a lot of inspiration for the players. It's always good to see fans, you know, galvanize the players on the court and get the best performance out of them. So shout out to those ladies for their contributions.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure OG Anunoby would definitely like to send a special thanks to Suni Lee because he was playing the game of his life when she
I ain't never seen you act like this before.
Yeah, it was one of those type of nights for him. Well, that's a wrap on yet another episode of the New 24. If you like what you've heard through the first 22 episodes, including this one, then please feel free to leave us a 5-star rating with comments letting us know what you think about the podcast across the platforms you use to listen to your favorite shows, as we can't thank you enough for your continued support. You can also give us a follow on the official social media platforms for the New 24 across Instagram and X as well at TNTF_ to make sure you don't miss out on any announcements regarding our upcoming episodes, including all the latest currently trending around the NBA. Make sure you don't forget to check out the latest edition of Second Chance Points as well, an extension of the New 24 podcast where you can hear me and Torrance discussing which route between the NBA G League, Overtime Elite, and the NCAA provides today's top recruits with the better path to the pros, in addition to breaking down the pros and cons of each one. Subscribe to our RSS feed as well at rss.com/podcast/TNTF. We got a lot coming your way with the playoffs on the horizon, so please continue to stay tapped in with us regarding all that we have coming for you. Once again, for myself, Gabriel Wilkins, and my co-host, Torrance Stagger, we appreciate you all and hope you all have a great week. So long, everybody.